This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
All right, listen up. It is time for a brand new Zoom through the universe in the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. This is the show with all the brand new, epic, amazing, and most importantly, deadly things that happen in the universe, and it's in one nice little chunky place for you. Today we're talking about one of the most dangerous beasts under the sea. Also, we'll take a trip to the smartest school outside of the solar system, and we'll chat to an animal expert all about how some creatures live their life completely in pitch black and they don't know any different. It's on the way after we catch up with Techno Mum and get some of your gadget questions answered.
Techno Mum, engineering explorers.
Everyone in my class is mad about fitness trackers. Mine measures my temperature, heart rate, the distance I've walked, and even counts how many steps I take. 999, 1,000 steps.
Pretty impressive. Although my target is 10,000. I've still got quite a long way to go.
Your fitness tracker is way cooler than mine, though. It even tells you how much sleep you get.
I know the answer to that. It's never enough sleep. I don't tend to use my fitness tracker at night, though. It's too uncomfortable.
What if they could put a fitness tracker inside you? Like an implant? It could take all sorts of measurements about your health. Kind of like a robot brain, keeping an eye on things.
Not sure I'd fancy being home to a robot, but it's a great idea. In fact, people are already experimenting with electronics in futuristic ways. Maybe you'd make a good electrical or electronic engineer.
Electrical and electronic engineers? So basically, they're the people who make gadgets work, right?
Gadgets? There's a bit more to it than that. Electrical engineers understand how electricity behaves. Electronic engineering is about putting that electricity to work inside machinery, using circuits and components. If you think about all the different kind of things that are powered by electricity or have circuit boards, you'll begin to see that this type of engineering could take you in a huge amount of directions. Your remote control car and drone have circuit boards inside, designed by an engineer to be able to take instructions from the controller. At a pop concert, electronics inside the guitars, keyboards and microphones will be carrying the music to the speakers. And they'll have circuit boards to carry out the job of making it nice and loud. And just about any type of vehicle that you can think of, cars, buses, trains, planes, boats, and even rockets, anything which has an electrical power source will have been designed with the help of electronic and electrical engineers, all designing the circuits to deliver the power where it's needed.
I guess you'd need to understand a lot about circuits.
That's right. Electricity behaves in a very particular way, depending on what material it's in contact with. It's also affected by things like magnets. Electrical and electronic engineers have to have a good knowledge of these things. And circuits use common components which electronic engineers will use as building blocks on the circuit boards. Much of the work is planned on computers, but building circuit boards will be done by machines or by hand using soldering irons. Here's some fun technology we can thank electronic engineers for. Virtual reality. This one's a roller coaster experience. I hope you're not afraid of heights.
Whoa, it's getting very high.
The electronic engineer has created a machine which translates body movements into changing images on the screen. Electronic circuits are carrying information from movement centers to the circuits, which process the computer images and back to the screen, all in real time. Hold on tight.
Whoa! That's so cool.
There are loads of cool jobs for engineers, almost as many jobs as there are inventions.
Engineering Explorers, created with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology to celebrate the Year of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/technomum.
We're chatting to Dr. Jeff Boxall from the Natural History Museum in a sec, all about how some life has adapted and evolved to live in a completely different type of light to us. That's in just a sec. First, let me very quickly remind you that if you want a shout out on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, the best way to do it is to leave us a review over on the iTunes podcast store. And it's the best way because it's the simplest way. Honestly, it's dead easy. You can find, open up your phone, or get out your phone or a tablet, open up the iTunes podcast store, then find the Fun Kids Science Weekly. When you're on there, leave us a review. Now, when you open that part, it gives you a nice little place to put your name, so I know who you are. There's a place to drop us 5 stars as well while you're there, and there's a comment box where you can write a message to me. In there, write anything you like. Honestly, we've had all sorts, from incredible questions to science experts that we've answered, and also we've had big thank yous to me, because people have used this show to test their teacher, which is always fun. So if you want a shout out on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, get onto the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, this summer, the Natural History Museum in London is exploring some of the world's strangest creatures with their brand new exhibition, Life in the Dark. They're having a look at the animals that never get to see the light. Now, Professor Jeff Boxall is from the museum, and he's on the phone to tell us a bit more. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Hi, Dan.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Now, I wondered if you could start off by telling us, like, what's the first thing that living in the dark does to a creature?
Well, we're so used to using our eyes for everything that it's hard for us to imagine how difficult it might be when you're active at night, when the light levels are very low. So many animals that are out there have enhanced vision. Their eyes are much, much better adapted than ours. They can't see colour, but they can see in black and white, but they can see really clearly at night, whereas we struggle very much. So we look at how vision is improved in certain nocturnal animals, but we also look at animals that use sound at night and animals for which smell is very important at night. So you can use other senses. You don't just have to use your eyes.
So I guess with the science of this then, tell us why, for us, for humans, living in the light, in the sun, is so important. What does it give to us to help us survive?
Well, it makes it easy for us to do what we have to do to survive. Now, by that I mean all animals, including us, we have to find food, we have to find a mate, and we have to not get eaten by predators. And really the theme of the exhibition is how you do that in the dark. Well, you know, humans use light. Light is very important for us. It helps us with our daily rhythm of, you know, sleeping at night and active during the day. So our bodies are very much adapted to life in daylight. But there are animals out there that are adapted to life at night.
Now, what are the strangest forms of adaptions that you know of how creatures suit themselves to life at night?
I think one of the star animals for me in the exhibition is the star-nosed mole. On its the end of its nose, it has a rosette, a circular array of 22 little pink feelers that are covered in sensory cells. So as it's tumbling underground, or it swims as well, as it's swimming in the water, these 22 feelers are actively twitching and feeling all around, and they can detect the presence of food particles even in the dark. So they can find the little worms that these star-nosed moles eat, and they can catch them in the complete dark.
I suppose another question is, why do they go out at night? Why are they nocturnal? Why are we suited to the daytime, but they found themselves only exploring and hunting during the evening?
There are quite a few animals that are active at night, and there are a number of different advantages. Firstly, there might be fewer predators around, so it's probably a bit safer to be out and active at night looking for food. The other reason is, in certain climates, it's very, very hot during the day. So in a desert, for example, it's too hot to be active during the day, but it's much cooler at night. So a lot of desert animals are active at night. And then the third reason is moisture. You know, animals like frogs and newts and salamanders, these amphibians we call them, they need to keep their skin moist, and it's much better for them to be active at night. So there are different advantages that compensate for the fact that, you know, they can't see as well because the light is much dimmer at night.
It's not the only reason, though, is it, Jeff, why some creatures need to cope with an absence of light? Because there are some under the sea, when you get down so far, that it's just the sunlight can't penetrate the water. Can you tell us about some of the curious animals that you'll find, you know, many, many, many metres down in the ocean who somehow manage to stay alive?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. Once you go 1,000 metres, that's a kilometre, down in the ocean, there's no sunlight at all. So you would think it was completely dark down there. But a lot of animals make their own light. We call it bioluminescence. They make their own light and they use these flashes of light to help find food, to help find a mate for signalling, for example, or to produce a bright flash of light if they're being attacked by a predator, to startle the predator and to make it move away. So the last zone of this exhibition, it focuses in on that. So we look at some of the extraordinary fish, and a big fat anglerfish which have a little lure, like a worm that they dangle in front of their mouth. And this actually glows with this bioluminescence. So smaller fish will come to investigate this and then chomp, you know, the big anglerfish will catch them. And then there are various other kinds of fishes, Dumbo octopuses, vampire squid. We have a wonderful film of vampire squid. They produce light as well, which they use to startle predators of their own. So, you know, there's always someone that eats you down there.
It's not just the bioluminescence, is it? Because I think I've seen almost a completely see-through fish that's floating around the bottom of the ocean. Is that the case?
There are a lot of animals in the oceans that try to make their bodies as transparent as possible, yes.
Why do they do that?
Well, the proteins in their body are specially adapted to let light through, so they're translucent. The only pigments they must have are in the eye. So you often will get a haul of plankton from deep water, and what you see initially is just lots of pairs of eyes because you can see their pigment. And then gradually you home in and you can see the sort of ghosted bodies that they have. So it's one way of hiding. You know, if you're in the water away from the bottom and away from the surface, there's nothing to hide behind. It's not like being in a forest where you can hide behind a tree or under a bush. There's nothing to hide behind the ocean. So if you're a shrimp and you taste good, one of the few ways of hiding is to try and make yourself as translucent as possible. And then you kind of blend into the background and make yourself invisible.
Oh, it's just evolution blows my mind every time I chat to anyone on the show. The fact that some animals over years and years and years have developed this ability to become see-through is just astonishing. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show. The Natural History Museum's Life in the Dark exhibition is on from the 13th of July, so probably right now, till the 6th of January next year. Loads of chances for you to see everything that thrives in the dark. Professor Jeff Boxall, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Right, it's time for this week's Dangerous Dan then, talking about the most mean things in the universe. Now, on this part of the show, for the last year or so, we've been pretty out there with our deadly stuff. You know, huge dying stars, colossal, terrible diseases. But today, it's something that you know is dangerous from the sea. You've heard all about it before, but I'm not sure that you quite understand just how deadly it is. You see, the stingray, it's related to the shark. They're common in tropical coastal waters all over the world. There are about 220 known species of stingray, and they breathe through openings that are just behind their eyes. They've got these thick jaws as well that allow them to eat smaller creatures. It probably won't take a bite of you, but it's what's on the other end of the body that should really scare you. Their spinal blade. It's about 10 centimetres long, very sharp, very thick, and it can cut through wetsuits when you're swimming. And once it's stabbed, it pushes through this searing, toxic venom. It causes shocking pain, and the worst part, the stinger that they stab with, it usually breaks off inside the flesh, leaving some of it and its toxic poison behind. Now, thankfully, they don't usually attack humans randomly. They need to be provoked, but still, come on. That stinger, it is deadly enough to land it on our Dangerous Dan list. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's get another episode from our speakers series. This is all about how you can listen to what I'm saying right now.
The speakers. The speakers. Transmission. Masts and towers.
The speakers have been checking out the masts and towers which help transmit radio and TV programs. And Subbo has a lot of questions.
So this transmitter is brilliant and all, but I'm a little bit worried.
Scared of heights, right?
I love it up here. You can see for miles. Well, hey.
Nah, not that. I mean, what about people who aren't near the transmitter? How are they going to hear your cool song, Woof?
This isn't the only transmitter, you silly speaker. There are over 2,000 transmitters across the country, from the Highlands of Scotland to the Cornish coast, in the middle of busy towns to the peaceful countryside. Some are on towers. They're tall, thin buildings which stand alone. And sometimes they're on masts, metal structures that sometimes have guy ropes and cables supporting them.
I've seen them on the top of tall buildings in the city too.
That's right. Often it'll be the tallest building there is. Anything to help the radio waves to travel as far as they can without hitting other buildings, hills or trees. You should keep your eyes open when you're travelling around. You'll start spotting them in all sorts of places.
And, guys, there's a whole bunch of other masts too, you know.
What? Like the ones on a pirate ship?
Ahoy, matey! Well, there aren't any pirate ships these days, so not those.
I'm talking about mobile phone masts. There's over 52,000 of them, helping me to post pictures to all my friends. Oh, how about a nice selfie with the transmitter in the background? It's so big. I wonder how they build them.
Carefully, very carefully.
Must be an epic job.
Towers and masts are built and fixed by people called riggers. Sometimes they assemble the mast on the ground and winch it up. Other times, especially with towers which don't have cables supporting them, they have to be built piece by piece, like a giant Lego structure.
You'd need a lot of bricks for that. So, if the taller the better, where would we find the tallest transmitter in the country?
That's easy. Let's check out one in Yorkshire called Emly Moor.
Whoa! Massive!
It's over 300 metres tall and is one of the tallest radio towers in the world.
It's called a tower because it hasn't got any wires supporting it, right?
That's right. Although this is actually the third tower built on this site. The first one was replaced and the second one unfortunately fell down because of a build-up of ice.
I wouldn't want to be the one to have to keep it clean.
It's certainly a full-time job. Engineers have to be specially trained to fix and repair masts and towers. A lot of maintenance goes on all year round to keep them working safely.
Sounds kind of dangerous.
It can be, but there's lots of rules about how they are built and looked after, which keep us all safe.
Including that sign saying, no trespassing.
Yep. Transmitters might look exciting, but they're not for playing near. Come on, let's get out of here. And hey, here's something I can play.
Uh-oh.
My next cool track.
The Speakers Transmission with support from Arkiva. Find out more at funkidslive.com/speakers.
It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly and it's time to take a trip to the smartest school outside of the solar system for a lesson with Professor Pulsar about space exploration.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Right, class, settle down. I'm about to be extra nice, and you won't want to miss that.
Yeah, it's like Pluto's orbit. Only happens once every 248 years.
I heard that. Your universe handbooks are looking superb. From gravity to wormholes, pulsars to parallax, you've done a cracking job of getting to grips with the, frankly, mind-boggling reaches of space exploration. To reward all your hard work, you can all go home early. How about that? All right, that's enough. We're not quite done yet. To finish off this term, I asked you to come up with some great reasons to get exploring space. Who'd like to go first?
Well, a really great reason to explore space is because it helps develop cool inventions that you can use on Earth. Or any planet you like. Sorry, Blurb, I forget Earth's not the only planet.
Aren't all inventions super clever engineering things like rocket exhaust pipes? I'm sure they're very impressive and all that, but I wouldn't call them cool.
Nah, nothing like that. I've brought a few inventions I use every day that are a result of space exploration. Here, catch. This is my cycle helmet. I wear it to protect my head when riding my bike. It's really light, isn't it? Shock-absorbing foam in it was developed in the 1960s as part of the Apollo space program.
Nice! Love the colours too. It looks like a nebula.
Thanks. I painted it myself after we went nebula diving last term. Here's something else I like playing with when I'm at home.
A games console? I don't think astronauts on the International Space Centre would get much work done if they were playing Rocket Wars all day.
Not the game, the microprocessor inside it. If it wasn't for the space exploration, computers might still be as big as a room. And the joystick was originally developed for Apollo's lunar rover in the early 1970s.
I think the lunar rover would have been more fun to play with than a computer game.
Well, yes, definitely. But these are a little bit easier to buy.
Very good presentation, Alex. 10 out of 10. Hey, I've been extra nice twice in one lesson. I'm on a roll. Don't spoil it for me now, Stats. What have you got for us?
A great reason to explore space is that it's a challenge.
Stats, aren't challenges usually hard work and a bit, well, boring?
Is a tricky level on that computer game of yours boring? Or is riding your bike down a really bumpy hill? Does it send you to sleep because it's just such a boring thing to do?
Nah, I love doing that.
There you go. Sometimes things that are a challenge are brilliant fun.
That's actually true. I once got stuck in a game for 5 weeks, and when I completed it, I was so happy I fell off my bike. Probably shouldn't have been multitasking there.
You see, me, I love a challenge. It's easy to measure the stuff in front of you. Anyone can do that. But who wants to be just anyone? Being able to work out how heavy a star is, or to work out the temperature on a distant planet from millions of miles away, now that's the really cool stuff.
Fantastic, Stats. Who's next up? Electra? Come on then, let's be having you. Good to see you tightly screwed together today. Off you go before something works loose.
A great reason to explore space is because it's exciting. You never know what you might find out there. Maybe a binary star system, a black hole, or even a nebula that looks like Blurb.
I agree with you, Electra. One of the most exciting things of all that you might find out there is other life forms.
That's right. After all, not everyone can come to deep space high, but everyone can get involved in space exploration. You just need a dark night and no clouds. And on that happy note, we shall end the lesson for today. But remember, it's just the start of your space exploration adventures. Class dismissed.
Deep Space High. The Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
There are loads more chances for you to get some lessons from the smartest school outside of the solar system with Professor Pulsar. We've got all the episodes that you can download and listen to over on iTunes, which is the best place to find all of our incredible science series. They're also on the free Fun Kids app, and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. And remember, you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.